Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Show Talk with Angela Butler. I'm here to inform, entertain, and enlighten you, the listening audience. So let's all learn something tonight. I'm here every Monday, Thursday, and Saturday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 5:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. Tonight our guest is Mr. Kevin Wendell Thorburn. Kevin Thorburn is the author of Harlem Sun. Harlem Sun is about the life and times of K. Wendell Thorburn. The recommended reading tonight, of course, is Harlem Sun, the life and times of K. Wendell Thorburn. How are you tonight, Kevin?
I'm doing well. How about yourself? Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. You're more than welcome. As a child growing up, you would listen to radio and read the newspapers. In your book, you write about the Black Power movement. What was it like to be a part of that time era?
Well, actually, for me, as a child, during that time, and we're talking about the mid-1960s, it was an exciting time for me because I saw the changes in terms of, you know, in terms of the way people dressed, hairstyles. It was the time where people went from processed hair to natural hair, and it was also you know, you heard talk of things like, you know, black is beautiful, and we went from, you know, calling ourselves colored Negro to calling ourselves black. So it was a seismic change during that time, and being right in the middle of it was very exciting for me because I really got to see the change in the society and really seeing how things shifted from living in a segregated environment to a more integrated environment.
Okay. What was it like living around the corner from Langston Hughes, the poet?
Well, the second school I went to in Harlem was just a couple of blocks from my house at the time. Langston Hughes lived directly around the corner, and this was in the mid-1960s. And at that time, Langston Hughes was a little older. It was beyond a few years beyond the Harlem Renaissance. And he was an older gentleman, but he was still very active in the community. I saw him walking around. He would, you know, come into different classes at the school and speak to students and things like that. So he was a figure, a major figure in our community.
Okay. All right. Listeners, you hear Kevin talking about, Kevin Thorburn talking about Langston Hughes, the poet. You write about Muhammad Ali. What was his real name?
Well, Muhammad Ali was his birth name is Cassius Clay. And he was an important figure for me because during the early 1960s when he changed his name, that was really, it sort of divided a lot of people in the African-American community at that time, particularly amongst very conservative people. They felt that, you know, it was the first time they've experienced someone who would change their name like that. And, you know, it was just things that people didn't understand about that at that time.
Oh, okay.
And the older African-American fight fans remembered people like Jack Johnson. So they looked at people like Cassius Clay before he became Muhammad Ali as a loudmouth and arrogant and things like that. And they remembered people like Jack Johnson, and it brought a lot of discomfort to a lot of people in the community.
I believe your father, Mr. Thornborn, was one
right.
of those people, was he not?
Yes, he was. My father, it was interesting.
Way?
Yes, my father very much
That's
felt that
wrong.
Way. Absolutely.
Okay.
My father was very much that way. In fact, my father looked at people like Muhammad Ali as, you know, troublemakers and things like that. And that was confusing for me because my father was a Garveyite, and he followed Marcus Garvey. But I don't know, as he got older, you can see that how society had changed, and my father was slow to adjust to those changes because he was an older man at the time. So, but being a young teenager like I was sort of ready for that change, you know, because I felt empowered by it. And, but my father had a different view of it. So, it created clashes in our home, but it made me know that, society had changed, and for us to make those kind of adjustments to the new society, we had to change as well.
Okay. Your mother suffered from schizophrenia. Do you feel that the mentally ill are better off now than they were then? Do you think things have improved to the point where the mentally ill are better off? Because I know I had one gentleman on my show, Mr. Wayne Antoine, and he was saying that a lot of mentally ill people are homeless. So what I want to know is, do you feel that the mentally ill are better off than what your mother was?
Well, I think when I look at now, as opposed to the time my mother got sick, I think we're more aware of the illness. I think we probably have better drugs to control it. If you remember at that time, one of the remedies for mental illness was things like shock treatment and experimental drugs like Thorazine and things like that. And my mother went through all of that. I think now we have better drugs. We have our information about the illness is we've moved forward in terms of our knowledge about it. But I think overall, there's still a stigma about mental illness, although I think the policies around it are probably a lot better in terms of how society treats people like that, I think there's still a lot to be learned about it, and I think that in terms of treatment and residency and places where people like that are housed, I think there could be a lot more improvement overall.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Segregation was a part of your life. And it surprises me that there was so much discrimination in the North because I was born in the 1970s. That's when I was born, the early 1970s. The South was notorious for lynchings and beatings. According to your book, you were arrested and beaten by the police. Was this common in the North or in New York?
Well, you know,
for
when you look at
black men and women to be treated this way.
Well, when you look at the type of life that I was living at that time, you know, being involved in drugs and, you know, being arrested and things like that. That type of brutality, I think, was probably more commonplace around people who were similarly situated like myself at the time. But in terms of segregation, it's so funny because when people mention down south, there are progressive people who live in places like New York, which they call places like New York up south. And you would see the kind of segregation. Like, there were certain neighborhoods you couldn't buy a home in New York City. And in a lot of those neighborhoods are still that way. I think you would find, in terms of integration, I felt that the city was becoming more and more integrated, but there was still pockets of segregation, and I think it's still that way to this day.
It's still that way to this
absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely. I think if you look at a place like New York City, it's probably one of the most segregated places in the United States, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's something new to me because I've always lived in the South and I was born in the South. I'm like an hour from the Alabama state line. So
yeah.
This is something
yeah.
new to me.
I think that you would probably find more integration in the South than you would find in places like New York, New Jersey. In my feeling, my mother was born in Bessemer, Alabama, so I'm very familiar with the South. So I think that we have a long way to go. And in a lot of ways, we've probably lost some ground in terms of participation in society overall.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. The most interesting parts in your book are the historical time is the historical time period that you lived through. Do you feel that things are better now, or do we as Black Americans have a long way to go?
Well, the society we live in now, with all this pushback from, you know, people like the Tea Party and people who want to try to change and turn the clock back, I think although we progress in a lot of ways, I think we still have a lot of work to do. People think that we're in a post-racial society because of elections like Barack Obama, but in a lot of ways we really in a battle to hold on to what we have in terms of the advancements as a people. Like, there's a all-out assault on our right to vote in this next election, and things like that really make me mindful of the fact that we really could lose ground in all of our advancements, but we just have to be mindful to push forward. But
okay.
I think we've advanced in some areas, but we have a lot of work to do in other areas, like healthcare, taking care of our elderly, education of our children, and things like that. We still have a long way to go.
All right. What do you think? Speaking of President Barack Obama, what do you think of President Barack Obama? I mean, you live to see a president being elected that's Black American.
Exactly.
So how do you feel about this?
Well, you know, I'm just like a lot of people. You know, on election night, I cried like everybody else. On inauguration night, I cried. You know, just like everyone else. But, you know, I'm sort of on the progressive side of politics. So, you know, although I'm happy with a lot of the things the president has done, I just feel that there's a lot more that needs to be done. And but I do also understand that President Obama is president of all the people and not just of Black people. So, I know that I can't expect him to address all the issues that concern me, but it's my hope that if he gets a second term that I will see more advancement in terms of, you know, educating our children, housing our families, jobs for our communities, and caring for our elderly. Those are the issues that I'm most concerned about, like things like Social Security and unemployment and education and health care. Those are the things that I will look at in terms of where I see President Obama and the advancement of the African-American community.
Okay. All right. For listeners, we're going to go to break. We're going to play a song from Fareed Braxton, Good Afternoon, please don't log off or turn off your computer, because we're going to be right back with more of the interview from Mr. Kevin Wendell Thornborn.
Excuse me, I is doing love. Can I tell you that you're looking real, real nice with your sundress on? Girl, you're as pretty as the sky. I'm not the one to spit game or be the one to drown you with words. I just wanna know your name, and then I'ma give you mine in return. Your lips, your eyes. Girl, you gotta know that you are one of a kind. Tell me this, are you messing with some other guy? And if not, then maybe I can call you later on tonight and see what's going down.
Good afternoon.
Yeah.
I wanna know if I can get the chance to chill with you.
Chill with you.
Then maybe go catch a movie and grab some food.
Oh, 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 oh.
I just wanna get to know you. Then maybe I can get the chance to next to you and tell you good morning. Oh, yeah.
Now excuse me, miss, can I tell you this? Your beautiful skin's like a perfect 10. Your smile, your style, your sexiness look way more sweeter than a Hershey kiss. And you're wearing that dress with some shoes and a rest. I can tell that you walk around with confidence, and I really like the way you smell. Girl, I love the way you carry yourself. Like, whoa. Yeah, I know you done heard this before, but I'm about to tell you some more. That you're really, really, really beautiful. From head to toe, like, whoa. I really wanna take it slow, so we can reach that last level, where we both get that perfect glow.
Good afternoon. I wanna know if I can get the chance to chill with you. Then maybe go catch a movie and grab some food. I just wanna get to know you, then maybe I can get the chance to wake up next to you and tell you good morning. Oh, good afternoon. I wanna know if I can get the chance to chill with you. Then maybe go catch a movie and grab some food. I just wanna get to know you, then maybe I can get the chance to wake up next to you and tell you good morning. Oh.
All right, welcome back to Show Talk with Angela Butler. We are brought to you by the Digital Conglomerate Magazine, where we are more than just a magazine. We're a lifestyle. You can Google the Digital Conglomerate or call Garland McLaughlin at 206-279-1712. Also, Exquisite Design Company brings your living or office space to life with our customized design services. You can visit them online or call Garland McLaughlin at 206-279-1712. Or leave them a message and you'll receive a free consultation. All right, listeners, that was Fareed Braxton, and good afternoon. Kevin
yeah.
Thornborn. All right. You said you were talking about President Barack Obama, but there was another vice president wife that you met. You have met Tipper Gore, ex-Vice President Gore's wife at the White House. What was it like there?
Oh, it was a very beautiful experience. My younger son wrote a letter to the White House, and they invited my son and our family to the White House, and my son put the ornament on top of the White House Christmas tree that year. And that was a we had lunch and met Tipper Gore, and that was a very, very nice experience.
Okay. There was a blackout within New York State in 1965 and 1977. What do you feel when the looting took place and then the arrest? Were you afraid?
Oh, absolutely. I can remember in particularly the riots of 1965. I live in Brooklyn, New York now, and at that time I lived in Brooklyn, New York, not too far from where I am now. And there was a major shopping venue in Brownsville, Brooklyn, Pickin Avenue. And I remember the next day they said that a lot of the stores had been looted. And it was just unfortunate. When we went out onto the streets, it was just like a riot had broken out. And it was just very unfortunate. It took weeks to get things up and running, and you know, if you have done any research about that time, you know, people were arrested, and it just was just an unfortunate situation at that time.
I believe you wrote that in 1977 that there were 3,700 people arrested, the biggest arrest.
Oh,
at
absolutely,
that time in
New York City.
Okay. All right. You were a mediator for the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Yes.
What influenced you to pursue this career as a mediator?
Well, actually, it came.
Your book.
It was just one of those. I've always been somewhat of, you know, a person who always thought about, you know, conflict resolution and, you know, things like that. And, of course, you know, I had two teenage boys growing up, and preventing conflict was always a big thing in our household. So I've always had those instincts. But I think it started when I used to work in retail. I used to manage stores for a large retail company. And it was just conflicts in the store that I was, you know, it was my job to resolve a lot of the conflicts. And one of my coworkers, who was a good friend of a gentleman who was a director at the EEOC, he says, "Kevin, you would love to meet Michael Purdy, and he would fall in love with you." And I took the class at Cornell University, the School of Law in Midtown Manhattan. And I took the class, and Michael Purdy, who at that time was the director of the New York District Office of the EEOC, he just liked me, you know, and he just thought that I would be good. And since I was a non-attorney, he used me as an example during the training session to show that, you know, non-attorneys can do this work. And he always, till this day, he calls me in to just display that, you know, it's not a work that just attorneys can do. And he trained me, I was there in that office for almost 11 years, and of those 11 years, I had the highest settlement rate for 6 years. So
okay.
I was pretty good at it. So
you were good. All right. Okay. A mediator. Are you still a mediator?
Well, I'm
retired
now, but you know, conflict resolution is you know, it can happen any time, you know, to try to defuse conflict. It can happen on a train. It can happen in a public setting. You know, it can happen amongst family members and things like that. So I guess I could never retire from the work itself. But I just feel like I've been blessed with that type of ability. So, you know,
okay.
I don't think it was anything that I could possibly train for. I think it was just something that I had inside.
You had inside of you. Okay.
Right.
To be a mediator, okay.
Yeah.
When the Twin Towers were hit, where were you at? And what were you thinking? I've read the book, but the listeners haven't, so.
Well, actually, I was doing a case. My office was at 7 World Trade Center. So I was just always in that area. And even with my other work that I did at the time, that office was just around the corner from the World Trade Center at 115 Broadway. So I was always in the World Trade Center area almost every day. And that particular day, I missed my train because I was looking for a tie, which is something I never did before, you know, ponder a tie or ponder. I would just get dressed and go. And I remember that morning just fussing to try to find a tie that I could not find, which forced me to miss my train, which kept me out of the area when the planes hit. So my guess it was probably forces that were just telling me that I should not be in that area. And because I was doing things that morning that I wouldn't ordinarily do, so that told me that God was telling me not to go that at that time, to be honest with you. And fortunately for me, I was not in the building at that time, because, you know, Building 7 along with Building 1 and 2 were completely destroyed that day. So
yes,
I feel blessed not to have been there.
Yeah, the suicide bombers.
Yeah.
Get those buildings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I hope I pronounced this right. If I don't, please correct me.
Go
correct
ahead.
Me, please. Momaya Abu-Jamal.
Oh, his name is Momia. Momia Abu-Jamal.
Was a journalist on death row.
Yes.
Was he ever executed?
No, actually.
Oh,
yeah. Yes.
I did some research, but it didn't bring me up.
Yeah, Momia was a journalist in Philadelphia, and he was arrested for killing a police officer that night. And from Momia's point of view is that he's an innocent person, and he was on death row for over 25 years. And now, just recently, there was a court ruling in his case, and instead of being on death row, I think he will receive a life sentence. Although having a person spend the rest of their life in jail is no small suit, you know, but I think it's a good thing that he's not on death row, thinking that, you know, one day, you know, he'll die in prison. But it's just one of those cases that it had a national attention for a long, long time. A lot of stars and entertainers took up the cause, and it's just one of those cases that will be part of. Our country and our country's history, and the thing that I'm most impressed when I've had all the years that I follow the case is the dedication for people who really support Momia. So, like people like Pam Africa and Ramona Africa, and the people who have been there from the beginning, they have been stalwarts in his support. So. In fact, they're going to have a rally in Philadelphia, and they'll have 1,000 people in Philadelphia around the case. So they're still dedicated people. Just one of those unfortunate situations, but, you know, we support them, and we'll always support them. Absolutely.
People support him. Okay.
Absolutely.
Frankie Lyman, you would see him. Frankie Lyman was a singer and an actor, I do believe.
Oh, I
know.
Yes.
I watched
Twilight growing up,
fall in love with Halle Berry and Michael Fox and him.
Exactly.
You would see him. What was your impression of him? Because
well,
I watched Why the Fools Fall in Love, the Frankie Lyman story.
Right. Well, see, growing up as a kid, Frankie Lyman was to me as a teenager the same way that people enjoy and adore Michael Jackson. Frankie Lyman was that same kind of person. He was a young entertainer. I used to see him in Harlem. He lived in Harlem and I would see him, and he was a huge star at that time. He was a huge, when I was a kid, Frankie Lyman was a huge star. He would make movies, he would sing and dance, and he was just a phenomenal entertainer as a teenager at that time. So he was the precursor to Michael Jackson in that late 50s, early 60s period.
Oh, okay. All right.
Now, he was huge. He was a huge star at that time.
He was a huge star.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. You wrote about your shoe store. Can you talk about your trips to Italy for my listeners?
Well, I remember I was working at the time. I was working for, this is in the mid-1980s, and I was working for a shoe store. And the owner of the shoe store took me to the New York Coliseum. At the time, it was a major venue for all of the shoe wholesalers from around the world. And all of the shoe buyers for all the retail operations would come, and that's where they would buy their product. And I was just so fascinated by it. And I grew up, you know, around the business, around the clothing business, the shoe business. And I was just fascinated by it. And I remember I came home and I told my wife at the time that I was going to take all our money and move to Italy and start my shoe business. And she told me, I thought maybe she would tell me that, you know, you're crazy. She told me, but she told me that if that's really what I wanted to do, that I should do it.
Okay.
So I did. So I moved to Milan.
Right.
I lived in Milan for 6 months.
Oh, okay, Milan, Italy.
I lived in Milan, Italy for 6 months.
Fascinating.
Yes, it was fascinating. And I, you know, I started a shoe company, and then I opened a store. I shared store space with Cheryl Lee Ralph's mother, the actress Cheryl Lee Ralph. Ivy Ralph, in her own right, was a fine clothing designer in Kingston, Jamaica, and she had a small shop in Hempstead, Long Island, and she offered to share store space with me. And that sort of gave me that, you know, a certain gravitas in respectability for the stuff that I was selling. And as a result, it just made the company grow. So it was just a very fascinating and exciting time.
Okay. Listeners, we're going to go to break. You have been listening to Kevin Wendell Thornborn, the author of Harlem Sun, The Laughing Times of Kevin Wendell Thornborn. We're going to go to break, and we're going to listen to Fareed Braxton. right, listeners, that was Fareed Braxton, and She's Gone. We have with us tonight Mr. Kevin W. Thornborn, or Kevin Wendell Thornborn. Also, I'd like to say that the Digital Conglomerate is an online magazine where we are more than just a magazine. We're a lifestyle. You can Google the Digital Conglomerate or call Garland McLaughlin at 206-279-1712. Also, Exquisite Design Company brings your living or office space to life with our customized design services. You can visit them online. I call Garland McLaughlin, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, at 206-279-1712. And leave them a message and you receive a consultation. All right, Kevin.
Yes.
Mr. Fred Hamilton and Mr. Mark Clark were killed at a shootout with the police in Chicago. Now, in your own words, you said that Mr. Fred, in your book, you said Mr. Fred Hampton was a great warrior and spokesperson for the Black Panther Party in Chicago and around the country. That was
right.
His own words from your book. Yes,
right.
Sir, from your book. How did Chicago Black Americans deal with this?
Well, at that time in the progressive movement, I was always, a young progressive person. I was one of those people that was fascinated by, seeing the Black Panther Party, the first time they came on the news from Sacramento, and then seeing the programs, and when I lived in Harlem, the programs, the breakfast programs and the educational programs that they had. So I was always moved by that movement at that time in the late 1960s, and the day that they had the shootout in Chicago, which really just devastated most of the people who would follow the party at that time, and it was just so unfortunate to see that happen, and particularly with the way it happened, they lived in an apartment on the south side of Chicago, and the police just came and opened fire and just killed everybody in the apartment. It was just a devastating occurrence.
Devastating occurrence, yes.
Right.
But that's a part of American history, not just
Black
history.
Oh, it's definitely part of...
That was the time period, and those were the things that happened.
That happened,
and unfortunately,
exactly.
Back then, there was not a lot that could be did about it.
Well, because it was a lot of... As we found out later in the 70s, there were programs to undermine organizations like that, programs like COINTELPRO, were programs that sent agent provocateurs into communities and organizations to just undermine the organization. So, and organizations like the Black Panther Party fell victim to it.
Was there a court ruling about Mr. Fred Hamilton and Mr. Mark Clark? Was there any court rulings or anything?
Well, I think later on, Fred Hampton's son, Fred Hampton Jr., is an activist now. And if you could Google his name, and there's tons of information about him. He travels all over the country, and he speaks, just as ferocious as his dad did, just a chip off the old block. But anyway... There was a settlement in that case for the families, and so it's just one of those things that happened in our history that we hope that we would learn from it,
Okay, all right, okay. Angela Davis was captured. What was your impression at this time of Ms. Davis, of Angela Davis?
Well. At that time, there was her involvement with George Jackson and Jonathan Jackson, and the shootout at Marin County where the judge was shot, and you know, a lot was happening. And she, when they found out she provided the weapons, there was an FBI hunt out for her. So every day you would see something. There was a TV show called The FBI. And before the show would begin, they would talk about who was on the top 10 most wanted list on the FBI file. And one of those people at that time was Angela Davis. And when she was finally captured, it was all in the news. It was just like front page. It was a front page news story, and people who at that time, as I said, that were in the progressive community, stood behind her, and we stand behind her today. But it was just a very, very trying time. Also during that period in the late 1960s, it was the shootout at UCLA with the US organization and Black Panther Party. So there's a long history of a lot of this stuff, and a lot of it is a result of the misinformation that was put out by operations like COINTELPRO. So,
okay. All right, listeners, you've got to go get the book. Not got to, but you need to, but it's really an interesting book. Kevin Wendell Thornburg, or Kevin W. Thornburg, is a wonderful, gifted writer. So I'm encouraging you to go out and buy the book. You love shoes and tasteful, expensive clothes. In your book, you talk about the way you dress, and you can tell it was very tasteful, especially as you got older.
Oh, thank you.
So I just want to compliment you on that.
Thank you. I'm sorry?
I was going to say, is that why your shoe store was such a success? Because you had clothing in them, it's, you know, tailored, beautiful clothing?
Well, just to give you a quick story, if any of your listeners have ever been to New York City in the 60s and the 70s, there was some great, great, like, men's clothing stores like A.J. Lester's and, like, people would know those names if they, you know, lived in New York City at that time. There were stores like A.J. Lester's and Cy Martin's and Leighton's. And I know people my age, if they have visited New York or been to New York, these names really resonate with people. Phil Cromwell and places like that. So as a kid, I was always around the clothing store. One of A.J. Lester's stores was in a building that was in one of the buildings my father managed. So I was very close with the management there. And so that's kind of how I got into it as a kid. And like most kids my age, you know, when we lived in Harlem, your parents dressed you up for no reason but to dress you up. And they walked up and down 125th Street on a Sunday dressed up, you know, for just to maybe go into the Five and Dime store or to the Soda Pop store to buy ice cream and stuff like that. So we grew up in that particular culture. So it kind of stayed with me through my adult life.
Okay. All right. We're about to round down the show. Where can your book be bought?
Well, my book is available on all online bookstores like Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, and, you know, it's everywhere. It's in stores everywhere. So it is still available, although I published it about a year and a half ago. It's still available at all the online bookstores. So.
All right.
And I'm writing a new book, so I'll have my new book coming out at the end of the year. So.
All right. Okay. I look forward to hopefully receiving a copy of it and having you on the show when your new book comes out.
I look forward to it.
Yes, I look forward to it, too. All right. Well, listeners, this has been The Best of Angela Butler. My guest and I have informed, entertained, and hopefully enlightened you. Mr. Kevin Thornborn, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it. And listeners, see you next week at the top.
Yeah, it's your boy King B, man. Shout out to 3-Way Entertainment, Grind Time Music Group.
What's happening,
Big B?
What's happening?
My boy Haitian boy over there.
I don't see you five with them. Yeah.
And me?
What they got?
They call me Mr. November, man. Lego, big money getting. Freestyle writing, you can call it good written. Your beat could be a victim. Bitches, I fuck them. Haters, just forget them. Done on the waistline. I'll go fifth them. Niggas, I'm sick, but I didn't mean to ill them. Bitches are like cards, so you know I deal them. Just like a pickle, she suck my lollipop. Sickle dick, dick like a magazine. Bitch, get you an issue for one night only. Your boyfriend would miss you. Bitch, I'm the bomb. Nuclear missile. EB take shots off the dread like a pistol. EB run the track like Bristol. And I'm something to remember. And these other niggas just trying to be.